Good morning. If you are wanting to follow along in the outline, it's on page 42 and 43. And we flip-flopped this morning after reviewing one another's final notes. So we'll begin with the second page. I want to emphasize one aspect of the title of this seminar, and that is appreciating what is delightful. And there are two things I want you to walk away with. There's a lot of things that you'll hear this week. Hopefully these two little things will stick. The rest may be just a little additional bonus this morning. And I hope that it's both encouraging and very practical so that it can be useful as you return to your schools. As we work with students in teaching literature, I think the most important thing that we can do in helping them to appreciate what is delightful is to love it ourselves. If we don't love literature, we should do something else. So if you're not finding yourself reading for enjoyment, I think that's a test of maybe not loving literature. Now, I do know that there are phases in life where it doesn't work to read. So there are times when we can read more and times when we can read less. I recently finished a doctoral process, and for about 10 years, I read other people's assignments. So I'm now in a feast mode of reading things that I want to read just for me. But if you read my bio, you'll laugh along with me. Yes, I love to read. So please do read a lot. Read in class with your students. Read what they're reading to understand it, even if you don't like it. Mm-hmm. You have more to talk about and more of a platform to woo them to what you do think they should be reading as you enter their world a little bit. So I've read the first Harry Potter. That was actually enough to have that conversation. I didn't need to read the rest, and it's been a while. I must admit I haven't read that other thing, Twilight, that one. haven't gone there yet. Then talk about what you read. Have conversations with your students about it the same way you say, what did you do last weekend? What did you read? What are you reading on your own? What are you going to read this summer? Not for school assignments. What are you reading? Tell me about it. And get it part of the conversation and get it part of the conversation what you're reading for your own enjoyment as well. Talk about what you like and the difference between liking something and appreciating it. There's a useful term that I ask my students to grasp, and that's the idea of literary merit. I think literary merit has six components that they can understand at the middle and high school level. There is, in literary merit, some emotional appeal of a work. Students should be able to see that there's a response to it emotionally. Story has that component. There's a universality about great literature, things that speak into our lives more broadly, not just about a particular instance, but wider than that. Mortimer Adler said, the great books are the books that grow with you. When you return to them, they too have changed. There's also in literary merit an idea of artistry. A well-crafted story has literary merit. There's something to be said for permanence. There are a lot of things that didn't survive from the Renaissance. The fact that Hamlet did says something about it. That alone isn't a qualification, but it's a component of literary merit. There's also an intellectual appeal for literary merit and helps to stimulate our minds to think more deeply. I find enjoyment in what I call beach reads, but that's not great literature, and there's something to be said for the depth of the great literature as well. And there's an individuality. It's not the same story over and over again, even though Doug Wilson mentioned to the administrators' conference yesterday, there are only 7 stories in the world. They're just told differently. So maybe there's something to this idea that the telling itself has bearing on literary merit. And I think there's value in helping our students understand that we don't actually like everything equally. I teach my students Jane Eyre. It's on the assigned reading list. It's been there since before I got there, and I value it. I do not like it. She is such a whiner. Pardon me, some of you may find it your favorite. It is not my favorite. But I think that opens the door for them to understand that an affection that I have for literature is something they can acquire, even if it's not for the same literature. And I find victory when a student walks away at the end of the year, or as happened this year, a parent reported this, saying, I actually like reading now. That's new for a few of them. The second point I want you to walk away with is that story has an element of pedagogy. It can be used instructionally. That's not all it is, but it really is useful in that way. Think about how universal the appeal of story is. You've got an image in your head of library time and the children sitting enthralled as they listen to the story reader, or of adults watching movies, reading books, listening to stories told about themselves or about others. Think about how much of history is narrative, is story. How much of scripture is story? Think about all the examples of specifically didactic literature that we do have: parable, fable, allegory, moral tales, the mystery and morality plays of the Middle Ages, even the Apostles' Creed. A footnote to James Sire on this one. If you read the Apostles' Creed or recite it through your mind again, you'll notice that after the first statement, it's a story. Story disarms the heart. It prepares us to learn the lessons to be learned. But it does it in a way that gives us kind of an example on steroids. I've taught Hamlet for 23-ish years. And in that time, I have had one student who experienced a murder in their immediate family. That's an unusual circumstance. But I've had many students who've experienced conflict, separation, divorce, remarriage. Many students for whom that story can disarm their heart to understand more about the world, about us in our human condition, and about our Creator God. I think there are a few things that we can specifically learn about the character of God from studying story. One is taken from Hebrews 12:2. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. If God is the author of our faith, and we understand what authors do with literature, how carefully they select every word, arrange every sentence, every phrase, then we begin to understand how carefully he is doing that arranging and selecting with our faith. And he's the one who's writing our stories. And then secondly, Ephesians 2:10, for we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do. I am not a Greek scholar, but I do know this. The word workmanship is the word poema. Need I say more?
Well, it's been a it's interesting. We've had similar experiences. I've been reading a lot of stuff, of the last 10 years, for the last 10 years because of a project I was involved in, the Omnibus Project with Veritas Press. So I've been kind of on a reading gorge this last year now that the project is done. I'm going to talk a little bit about basically seeing what we need to get done, seeing the task at hand, and then secondly, looking for some signs that we might be starting to accomplish the work that we're after. The first thing is seeing the task at hand. As you're reading books with students, what are some of the things that you should be looking for? And the first thing I would say is this, that the students need to be reading with understanding. And often this is the point where students fall down. And if they fall down at this point, nothing else that you do is going to be nearly as effective. This happens because we think the students are very bright, and they are, but they're still students, okay? And hopefully the books that you're reading with them are fairly difficult. Now, I have a kind of a funny story about one of my brightest students who, when I was first reading through Notes from the Underground, with a group of kids, there were actually five of us in the room. We read some of it out loud in class, but sometimes I would send them home with reading, and that's where it gets more dangerous, right? When you send them home with reading, because they might do it or they might not do it. And if they do it, they might not understand. Now, this kid was hyper conscientious and just a great kid from a wonderful Christian family. And at one point in Notes from the Underground, the guys go off to a brothel. OK, and he came in the next day and I said, did everybody understand their reading last night? And he raised his hand and he said, did they go into some house? And everybody, the other students looked at me like, now what's he going to say? Don't we have a policy on this? They looked down at me and I said, yes, Aaron, they went into a house. And he said, what kind of house was it? Well, what were they doing in the house? It's like, we got to answer these. But a very bright student just didn't understand what was going on in the story. If you're not doing this, note this, that you might have a literature list that's this long, or you might have an omnibus textbook that has umpteen chapters in it. Only read as fast as you can read well, okay, so that the students understand. And I have to combat this problem. This is the way that I combat it. Strategy number one is read out loud with your students. Read out loud. Actually, reading silently is a modern, it's a modern, by that I mean like the last, I think Augustine's the first person that mentions silent reading. But read out loud with your students, and here's why. You can listen to them read. And when you listen to them read, it's like playing cards with them, with their cards facing you, because they can't fake it. When they don't understand what they're reading, they will bumble over things. And then you can help them. You can say, stop. This is what's going on at this point. And then also what I would say is another technique to this is test them for their understanding. The harder a book is, the shorter the turnaround time for giving them some kind of feedback for me and for them on whether they're understanding it. This last year, I taught Omnibus 5, which is the advanced course in medieval literature at our school. And it's one of my favorite courses because it has my favorite book in it. So I got to teach the Divine Comedy to my students. The Comedy, however, is not an easy book. You should read it every year because it gets better and better every time you read it. But I can hand it out to my teachers, and most of them won't get anything out of it the first time that they read it. So giving it to 11th graders and expecting that I can send them home with five cantos a night to read is ridiculous, okay? So I send them home with a little bit of reading, or we read some in class. And then afterward, I give them a test. Now, what makes the Comedy a little bit easier is that we read sections of Aquinas' Summa Theologica before that. So Dante sometimes seems like a little bit of a downhill trot after Thomas. But here's the kind of, I would give them four very easy comprehension questions, basically, just to show me that they had read and understood on a basic level before we discussed concepts, that they had read and understood what this work that we were doing. And I would give them 100% if they got 3 out of 4. Okay. So basically, just show me that you did the reading, you did it, because you could, one of my most terrible reading assignments was, the first time I taught through Aristotle, I was a day ahead of the students reading, or like an afternoon ahead of them, and I assigned 50 pages of Aristotle's Ethics one night. Now, if you've ever read Aristotle's Ethics, this is how it worked for me. I still remember laying on a couch, and I got my book out, and I went through the first paragraph. And I got to the end and I said, got nothing out of that. Started again, got to the end, still nothing. Third time, nope. Fourth time, wow. I thought, I sent the kids home with 50 pages. This was like back where email, the kids wouldn't have had email. It was back in the dark ages. And at that point, I came into class the next day and half my class was chipper. because they had quit, and the other half was looked like zombies. Okay, so they fall down on the level of understanding. Second, you need to read with connection. Okay, seeing how the books speak to one another. They note this, that schools sometimes are the worst place to learn things because students think that they're learning them for some kind of fake thing that we support this with the whole industry, right? We have report cards and we pat them on the back and we give them medals and things like that, which basically for some of them means I faked learning really well. I have this talented mind that sucks in things and can spit them out, but never keeps them in. So challenge them to think across disciplines. Challenge them to think across books. So, if you're reading Austen and Dickens, compare relationships, compare writing styles. I always have these odd questions, like, and you can do this basically in discussion. In essays that make comparison, and I really like to do it. I make most of my midterm and final tests these comparative. Dante gives us a view of the seven deadly sins in the Inferno, and Spenser in the Faery Queen gives us in the parade at the House of Pride. What's similar? What's different? Or just pick one. And talk about how they look at them differently. But if your student can't take an idea and move it from one place to another, I would bet that they're not really getting a deep level of understanding of what you're reading. Then the last one is read with application. Challenging the students to read with their own lives in mind. Okay? True story. I was sitting there reading with students. First time we were reading The Republic. And we start talking about Plato and his ideas, and how the world is made of shadows. And one of my students, brilliant kid, now runs his own business. And he muttered under his breath, stupid, 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 about Plato's Republic. Now, I didn't send him down to the office. I would have had to send him down to my office. So that, how does that help? But I was like, oh, no, stupid. So we just stopped. And thankfully, we have a little courtyard in our Plato always talks about shadows of trees, So I pointed out at the tree in the courtyard and I said, is that real? So we dropped our books and we went outside and we played with the tree for a while. And we talked about atoms and how there's all this space in atoms. And I had to do that for like a day so that then what happened after a day or so of this playing with the ideas, I actually had 5 committed Platonists with me around. Then I had to start fixing that problem. But they wouldn't even engage with the reading until it really they saw how it really applied to their lives. It's amazing how Gnostic learning can become in schools. Okay? Do this. I'm going to have you write down one book to read. And then I'm going to tell you that don't do anything with what you learn in this book until next year. Because you'll want to do everything at once. Read James K.A. Smith's Desiring the Kingdom. How many of you have read that book? Okay. That's the book I'm most evangelical about right now, besides Dante and Wendell Berry. That's it. Those two, and then James K.A. Smith. Just read that over and over again, and you'll see why the ideas and worldview you're trying to teach to your kids are like water running off the back of a sprightly duck. It's called Desiring the Kingdom. And basically it's this. His thesis is this, that Christian education fails because we think we're teaching students ideas and that really what we have to do is give them liturgies that train their habits to desire the right things. That education is really about desiring, not about knowing. I'm not going to tell you anything more about the book. You will love it. You will love it so much that you will find my email address at the top and you will write me and say, you were very helpful to me for that one book recommendation. And here are some signs that you're doing your job well. First, that students love broad reading. And here's when you know this. They will call you for suggestions of books to read when they don't have to read things. When they're going away to the beach. Now, you blaspheme beach reading. I read
beach books.
I don't read beach books. My last beach reading was Brown's biography of Augustine, and this great book by Gillespie called Nihilism Before Nietzsche. You just want to have those books on the beach. Come on. So, and also when they get together with you, they are deeply, they want to know what you're reading. It's like a card game where they're wanting to know what you're reading. You get to know what they're reading. And then you see students reading challenging works for their own good. It's like most people read challenging books, the great books. They read them like they're medicine for them. Okay? But when these people, especially when they pick, I tell them to do this, to read broadly and then to pick one book, one great book that you're going to read over and over and over again. I try to read a different translation of the comedy every year. Okay? Eventually, maybe we'll read in the Italian. Not yet. And then finally, you'll see that your students start to become useful. And this is what I mean by useful. They start to show real honor to what is due honor. And they start delighting in what is truly delightful. Okay? And this means that they start interacting with the culture, with their church, with cinema, with television. They start interacting with all of these things. And you'll see these things happening. When they start honoring what's honorable, a lot of it means that they're going to come back to you talking about things that are on the edges of culture. Okay? On the edges of culture, because really our culture doesn't produce too much that is worthy of honor and delight. I don't believe that any book written in the last 150, Austin is basically the last book that will be read over and over and over again. I hate Dickens, so throw him out. If you're big Dickens fans, come forward. See, if you didn't bring your rocks, that's great. Okay. This is also what you'll see, though, is this, that you will have students, you will see students showing disdain. And now, and note this, that's both good and bad. Sometimes you'll be embarrassed by how disdainful they are of things because they're still immature, right? So when the newest movie comes out and they disdain it, they look kind of arrogant, okay? So help them along with that arrogance, but then take a little bit of happiness, a little bit of joy in that, because everybody should be disdaining it, right? The reason they're disdaining it is because you've started to feed them really good things, and then it would be like somebody asking you to go on a Twinkie diet after you've eaten good Amish food in Lancaster County for a long time, fresh vegetables, okay? And eventually, you just wouldn't want to eat Twinkies. It wouldn't take very long. Okay, because most of what our pop culture creates is pablum and dribble, and that's what it is, and we should call it that. And when you see them calling it that, that's good. Now they won't always do that perfectly. I'd use myself basically as the standard of perfection for my alumni and students. And when they like something that I don't like, I typically say you're wrong. And then when they hate something that I like, they're definitely wrong. Okay? But what you'll find is they're moving in that direction of showing honor a lot of times for things that are older and more permanent, and then they're showing disdain for a lot of what pop culture produces. Okay? So we're going to get some questions now.
There are two questions relating to suggested reading lists, and I'm going to instead give you a reading list author. I mentioned him in the presentation. Mortimer Adler wrote a book called How to Read a Book, and his reading list is 6 or 7 pages, starting with the first things that were written, and really is a great place to start, and I think that's at least a good place to go. And then the other question had to do with contemporary suggestions, and I have to fess up, I go as far as Dickens. So because it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. But it is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune.
All he needs, he needs a good wife.
There we go. So,
No. I stopped before Dickens. What was the question again? I was reading this one.
20th century contemporary suggestions for how to.
I think Adler's. The books I think are most important are included in the omnibus curriculum. Okay, that's not all the way true though. Okay, because there are some books, and see, this is what's cool for me is because I do a lot of books in my classes that are not in the omnibus curriculum. I have chapters that you do not know about because some books are not omnibus friendly. So Anna Karenina is not omnibus friendly, not because it is bad. I think it's one of the best books ever written. It's my students' really favorite book right now. They despised me this year because we didn't read Anna Karenina again. Like, we read it last year. What's that? That's really good. It's too long to fit into omnibus, and I can't chop it up. I can't chop it up very well. Brothers Karamazov is like that. Okay. We read Atlas Shrugged, which I don't think is a great book, but it's very actually contemporarily important right now because it's kind of resurrected and come back to life in the libertarian movement. So, and this is what's funny about I'm a conservative. I'm conservative mainly because of William F. Buckley, but my students are typically libertarians. Okay. And I give them Ayn Rand and then I try to detox a little bit. Try to detox them so they don't get too far. But they look at Ayn Rand initially like candy. And then I have to tell them, you know, what's that bitter taste at the end? What is that? I would say that there are some books like that it just gets, the closer you get to today, the harder it is to make a judgment about a book. Now, see, I always throw the family into chaos out at the beach by saying our family meets out at a big beach house. And I always say no one will read Harry Potter in 20 years because we have some big Harry Potter fans and they just go ballistic. You know, they have sets of Harry Potter that they've already like in their wills send to their grandkids. Like, forget it. It's done. It's over. The next question, to what degree does cultural or historical literacy affect comprehension? How do you address this in class? Oh, illiteracy, that's right. Well, it addresses it exactly the opposite of literacy. What I would say is If your students are culturally or historically illiterate, then one of the deepest things you have to do in their reading is help them become culturally and historically literate so they get what's going on in stories. Because and I think that reading the great books is the detox to that, because it's expected that you will be culturally and historically literate. Okay? That's the brilliance of Austen, right? Is she just expects so much out of you. All the meaning is between the lines. You have to think it out. Like, this is why some of the boys that I read Austen with believe that she's into like black magic. Because the girls understand everything that's going on and The boys pray over the book and they. It's not there. It's not there. So if you want to get married, you better just keep reading. And what I would say is that if you just keep reading now, at Veritas, where I am, a lot of times as kids are going through grammar school, because what we do in history, what we do biblically, because in Christian history, the authors expect you to be biblically literate. Even unbelievers in the 19th century, early 20th century, they just expect that you'll be biblically literate. So you have to, in a good grammar school program, you keep building that in so that as you're reading, they are that. But if not, then you've got to work hard on that area. Okay.
We have enough questions for 3 hours, so we'll try. teaching students to love reading when most of us suck the joy out of it with constant testing, writing, over-explaining, et cetera, my solution to that is to actually read a little bit less and read it more deeply. So in the 11th grade class, we actually read a relatively short number of complete works of fiction. We read depth in poetry. I stop at each time period, and we spend a week or two on poem, and we do one poem for a full class period. And so maybe a sonnet takes us that much time to get through, but the students get time to interact with that. And then when we read the stories, to revert a little bit to that previous question, if that cultural and historical background is essential to understanding the story the first time through, then I give it to them. Otherwise, I let the story speak for itself the first time through. Because the books we read are the great books, and I do have some, albeit perhaps misplaced, hope that they will return to them again. I don't need for them to understand my 50 readings of Hamlet depth of understanding on their first reading of it. I think that probably would kill it for them. So I stop talking and let the book do the talking more often.
Okay, the next question is, what's the purpose of reading, studying literature? What a wonderful question. And what I would say is this. I was in a discussion last night about, and it was about James K. A. Smith, and it was about talking about what loves are we trying to implant in the lives of our students. And I answered with the words Wendell Berry. Now, I have to explain that now by saying that I'm going to answer the question for real now, which is, this is what I think is the purpose, not just of studying literature, but of all education, all study that we do. And I would say that that is the love of true peace. And that is peace with God and peace with your brothers. Okay? I think that that's the purpose of the liturgy that we go through at church, that it's the restoration of peace on earth. And that's what I want my students to long for in their hearts as we're studying reading and studying literature. I think it has these great side benefits, or not really side benefits, but it brings peace not just with the people around them as they enter into these stories together, but really it puts them at peace with the historical tradition that they're part of, like their fathers and great-grandfathers. They're entering into this same thing. So I think that's the purpose of studying literature and everything else.
How do you promote the sharing of books read independently in the upper grammar classroom? I think you can do that just with that same kind of conversation I mentioned earlier. What are you reading? What do you like to read? Making it part of that classroom interaction that can be just a little more free in a classroom that spends the whole day together. I think it's actually more difficult to do that when you have to get them in and out in 40 or 45 minutes. So take time for some of that. An idea that occurs, although I haven't seen it done, would be to focus some of your homeroom time each morning, one day a week, on what are you reading for fun? Why do you like it? And helping our students to be concise about their responses to that, but in a way that is capturing the essence of the book so that others understand it and can learn to love it too.
Here's another super question, which is, how does a school bring parents along into understanding the value of important central or the roles of literature and strong plays in education? It seems like something that you have to experience to understand. That's right. And here's some practical ways to do. Well, I would say first is this: how many of you are teachers here? Teachers? How many of you are administrators? Okay. I would just say this to teachers: I'm an administrator. I'm a school administrator. So try to make sure that your administrators are reading books like this. I think that this is like very protective for your school in the long run, that they really get what's going on. So I would start there. They're probably the most important people to be digging into this stuff, because I think they'll resonate with the right notes. But then what they need to do is to try to help your parents to get bite-sized portions of these things. And really what you're trying to do, if you're making making a cake, okay, and if you make a cake and you have all flour and no sugar, I don't make cakes myself, but I've heard this. If you have all flour and no sugar, you have a bad cake. Okay? Now, if you have all sugar and no flour, I'm not even sure that you don't really have a cake. Okay? Maybe a cookie or something like that. But what you need is, as you want to bring parents along, give them little things that they can read, easy things that they can read, because they need to trust you to be pulled further and further out into the deeper waters. Don't start with the Divine Comedy. They will hate you. Okay. Start. I really like my kick right now. I'm on a Wendell Berry kick. Okay. And I get the book That Distant Land, which is very easy, short stories that can be read about this little fictional town. And I every once in a while, I'll just kind of slip it into somebody's drink at a school mixer, you know, like, oh, you should read this. Oh, I've got a copy in my office here. And they start on this path, and then you see them kind of growing. But try to find those good little entry points. You know, now I've mentioned how I don't like Dickens, but like Great Expectations, I think, is an easy first read. OK, so try to find things that they can feel really happy about completing. OK.
A question about monitoring students' reading fluency and accuracy in oral reading. We don't grade it, but when I have the juniors read Hamlet, we read it all together in class aloud. One of the things that it does is equalize everybody, because nobody reads iambic pentameter spontaneously well. So you get a student who can't pronounce the word the in the middle of a line of that, and it really does help, but they become more fluent at it and more fluid in the reading of it just to get accustomed to it. So at the high school level, we don't. In the grammar school, we're monitoring that and working toward assessing it more formally in the near future.
Another super question. You guys are like the best. You're the best. What are some practical ways we can challenge students to come to class prepared for Socratic discussion so that they all will be engaged and involved in the text? You mean that your students don't come prepared for Socratic discussion? The first thing, remember, Socrates believed, this is what I always tell them when they're not prepared, Socrates believed that we knew everything anyway, so we might be able to dig around to something that you know. You probably already know the answers. But what I would say is this. That's one of the flaws that we've seen in how we do things over the last couple of years. And what we've done is we have a number of discussions with our students that are called graded discussions. Okay? And graded discussions work. I'm a developer of elaborate systems. I believe that the Ptolemaic system of the universe is really neat and cool. Wouldn't it be cool if it worked out that way? But you have to make it easy for your teachers to use. So what I did was, what we did was this, for most classes, we have a 5-point system. So if you make a comment during class that, you know, is a good question or shows that you did your reading, then you're going to get 1 point. Okay? And the teacher just has a little thing over there, and as the discussion's going along, something very easy for them so it doesn't suck them out of the discussion. If you make a super duper wow comment that shows like deep interaction with the text, you get 2 points. If you make a silly, nasty thing that just is a attention getting maneuver, -1. Okay? And if you get 5 points, you get 100%. Okay? So it's not out of the reach. Now, here's what you'll find is that this is what we found this last year. Our 7th graders never make a 2-point comment. They know their goal is 5. And some of them try to get 5 in the first minute. Yes. No, that yes is not a comment. Okay. Would no be a comment? But then, as it goes on, the 9th and 10th graders, and we actually this year we didn't do it with the 11th and 12th graders. We just decided they are what they are, and I'm not going to grade it. We're not going to put that artificiality into their conversation. So, but what we found was that really sobers you up a little bit. That, and we tell them beforehand, grade a discussion tomorrow, and boy, they are, even the ones that are not ready, they're ready. Okay.
Do you intentionally introduce samples of drivel so they begin to see the difference. It's a fallen world. I think there's drivel to be discovered in even Shakespeare, Austin, Dante.
Not Dante.
But I do think that some of the things that we read lend themselves to pointing those things out rather than letting the students discover them. So I do draw their attention to the weaknesses to say, okay, remember that 6-point literary merit thing. Where does this fall short? Where does it succeed?
How do you prevent your students from, is another great question, from faking reading, faking, i.e. using Spark Notes, et cetera, instead of actually reading? The answer to that is that if you give your own little idiosyncratic little comprehension quizzes, and don't, I mean, they might go to Spark Notes, they might try to get it that way. It's not safe. You're not going to monitor that the whole time. And honestly, for instance, if they're prepping for a test or something like that, I don't care if they go to Spark Notes to try to review what's going on. They just know that the stuff that I'm going to ask them, especially if you're doing those connections from one work to another, you just try to find that on Spark Notes. Just see how lucky you can get. The next one, what translation of the comedy do you teach? Okay, we actually teach two of them. We read the Inferno in eighth grade, and then we read the entire comedy in 12th grade. And I have different feelings, I have mixed feelings. We have Sayers and we have Musa. Okay, and here's my take on it, and we have it the opposite way of how I think it would probably best is that I think that Musa is easier reading. It's like easier to understand the text. So you should probably do that in eighth grade, Musa, but Sayers has better notes. Sayers, you kill for the notes in Sayers. So, and she gets things right that he gets wrong, I think. Those would be the two that I would say using. Sayers tries to keep the poetry of it, so she ends up, like if you and I were trying to make Italian poetry, some of the word choices she makes are pretty esoteric, which is a lot of fun, but, okay.
How important is it to teach from a meta theory of literature? Boy, I think in high school it's a little early. I let them know that the world is out there, but I don't try and instruct them in that world. Again, if I want them to love it first, that's not the avenue to loving it. That's the avenue of discovery after the love has been acquired.
Okay. Other than a four comprehension question kind of things, do you assess in other ways, chapter tests, essay questions, et cetera? Every once in a while we'll have like a class that's just about writing an essay. Sometimes I'm a big fan in the rhetoric years of having presentations that they make. So, for instance, we read Augustine's City of God at the beginning of last year, and I would ask little questions about the different chapters, and we had about 20 students in class, so you have to pick your chapter, and then you have to make a presentation introducing this chapter to everybody and then answering the question. So, for instance, Augustine has this position on whether Genesis 6:5 is talking about demonic cohabitation with earthly women. So I still remember Elise Nepley standing up and saying, "Demon child." I'm here to talk to you about the demon child. There's another. This would be my take. Don't overassess the world. I assess. We have 10. We go a semester, and we might get 15 or 20 grades. That's from September to January. We don't assess all the time. I've fallen into that habit sometimes, and I think it kills what you're doing. I also do this. We have what we call recitations, and we can do them many ways. My favorite way is to take two students out into the hallway and give them a little oral quiz. And what you have to do, if you really want to have fun with it, learn how to give false verbal facial cues. Okay? So, you know, so if you say, who did Dante meet at the top of Mount Purgatory? Was it Beatrice or Virgil or Satan? I know it's not Satan, but your face tells me that it is. So you can really actually unearth a lot of. But if you give it, note this, if you're giving like really true verbal cues, they really don't have to read anything. They can just read you.
And they're good at it. Can you talk more about disarming hearts using literature? How can students be transformed into the image of Christ while reading fiction stories? Well, excuse me. I think stories are a place where truth or falsehood can be expressed, and helping them to understand that gets at what all of the narrative of history and of the biblical history and world history, human history is about. So helping them to understand that the walls they put up in their own lives against learning life lessons are harmful is safer at a distance. It's more accessible to talk about someone else's failures than our own, and it's infinitely more successful and safe to talk about the failures of someone that we know we'll never have to meet. So life examples are helpful and beneficial, but I think the fictional examples give us that. So I just make connections for the students in the questions that I ask them to consider. So is this reality? Are people really like this? Are we ever like this? Are you ever like this? And is the path that this character walked the path that you want to walk?
Another great question. I love literature more than anything. That's not me saying it's them. But how do I get my students to like my favorite books like Paradise Lost or my favorite poets like Donne? How do you make them love it as well? It's not that they don't love anything. They love T.S. Eliot. So I'm not sure. Here's a couple of things. Number one is I remember having my head pressed down on my desk, ready to quit my job one day. And Wes Callahan from Scola Tutorials, who was working for me that year, walked by and he said, "You look like you're going to quit your job today." And I said, "That was what I was thinking." And my oldest students at the time in my school were like 8th and 9th graders. So if 8th and 9th graders don't like what you like, just note that that's the way life is. That's the way life is. Or as one of my 9th graders said, "I hate how people always stereotype us as hating everything." So, right there. Cannot be said better than that. But then what I would say is this. I just say, have confidence. Love it before them, and then note that more will get through than you think. When we were doing Omnibus 3, I got my old alums together, and I said, you know, we're going to have to cut some books out on the reading list. So you guys got to help me cut these books out. And Omnibus 3 is modern book, and we have Stephen Ambrose's book, Citizen Soldier, on there. And Priscilla, brilliant student, said, we should cut that book. Ben, who's on a nuclear submarine, said, that's the best book ever written. Stop it. And I said, "Well, Ben, what would you cut?" And he said, "Austin, nobody likes that." So Priscilla had a knife and was going to kill him. So couldn't let that happen. But Moore gets across, and they loved Hobbes. I don't think anything I told you about Hobbes was right. They're like, "We love him anyway." So can't cut Hobbes. Like, what is this, the comic strip you're talking about? So just have confidence and keep loving it and before them, and then give them a little time. And I bet you'll see that if you have a good rapport with your students and you and it simmers for a while, a number of my students love Dante. And that's so irregular. I feel so happy about that when I think about it.
What does it mean to teach literature at the logic level versus at the rhetoric level, and how do you do that? Well, that's a bigger question, but I'll start with this. I think getting the students Sayers taught us how to do it. Getting the students at that logic level, asking questions, directing them toward the right questions, giving them an arsenal of questions to start with is a good place to begin. And then at the rhetoric level, Ty already alluded to it, is getting them to see the connections between all the literature. It's not like the 21st century writers, well, maybe some of them are writing in a vacuum. There is a wealth of literature behind them, and most of them have read some of it. And I think the better writers of our current day will be those who have read more of what went before them and who've learned from its riches and imitated its riches and then done something new with it as well. So that's a starting point.
Another great question. How do you handle a books on curriculum that students and I agree are bad? Underlined twice. Literature, two question marks. Right. Characters flat and plot predictable from the beginning. Well, here's my... I've stubbed my toe very hard on this kind of thing. And note this. I would try to find... If you can't get it off the curriculum, which might be one thing, but don't... I would criticize the book after you read it, okay? I would read it, find what's good in it, because if you bomb your book the first day, and then if you go into class and say, this is a really bad book that's boring, but we're going to read it anyway, right, you see how that goes. But what I would say too is then I don't like to read bad literature books. I like to read bad philosophy books. Okay, like we read Hitler's Mein Kampf. We don't read all of it because he repeats a lot of things. You know, you get the point after a while. Aryan's good. And we read Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil. Okay, and we read Nietzsche because they're going to get hit in the face with him anyway. You might as well get prepped. So it's bad in that sense. Nietzsche is really good reading. But what I would say is, in this case, if you're going to criticize it at the end. You know, try to find something good and motivational to reading it, and then critique it as you get to the end. Okay? And read it quick and get through it.
How much time do you spend reading aloud with students in class versus assigned readings at home? I would guess it's about 25%, maybe as much as 50% in class. The novels, the longer works, I'm having them read more of that at home. But the poetry, occasionally I'll say, I want you to go home and read this poem X number of times. So they're spending time getting through it, and I'll tell them something like, first time read it really, really slowly. The second time read it really, really fast. The third time read it at a pace that seems sensible based on what you've now gotten from it. But a lot more time in class for the harder works, the more difficult to access works. And when's the last time you took a copy of Hamlet to the beach and read it to yourself? It's meant to be heard, not read like a novel. No comment.
Everybody wants to play the girl parts at my house, though. Four daughters. Here's a public service announcement from Ben House, the author of Punic Wars and Culture Wars, which if you... Where's Ben? Ben, wait, wave your hand. He's down there. If you want a copy of that book, which has become a controversial book here at the conference during this last day, and if you were at the administrative thing, you can chuckle about that later. He notes that Atlas Shrugged and other Ayn Rand books are given to schools free by the Ayn Rand Foundation. Did not know that. So you can pick up your Rand there. Also, Trinity Foundation gives away Without a Prayer and Answer by Rand. So you can tell they're evangelical Rand folks. And you can take advantage of that. Actually, it's against Ayn Rand's philosophy to give that book away. Right now, she's just whistling around in her grave.
Ty, have you read The Pleasures of Reading in an Age of Distraction?
Mainly, I'm just distracted.
I haven't read it, so I can't answer the question.
I'm not sure if I've read it or not.
Okay, sorry. Oh, that one's for you.
Why do you think the Divine Comedy is better than Paradise Lost? Well, mainly that if Dante wouldn't have written the Divine Comedy, maybe Paradise Lost would have never happened or something like that. I would just say that Dante for me is it's more comprehensive. Okay, it's hell, purgatory, which of course I'm Protestant, so, and purgatory is my favorite part, which is really stupidly ironic. But I think that purgatory is about how God uses suffering to make us into who we need to be. That's why I think it's that purgatory for me is the most applicable part of it's James K. Smith got most of his ideas from there, I think, too. And then it's about the restoration of personality and community in heaven. So I think Dante is more comprehensive a story than Paradise Lost. I love Milton. Don't get me wrong. Very good. Much better than Dickens. But Dante is the poet. The poet.
What do you do if you have a student who just can't keep up with the reading assignments, struggling with comprehension, and especially at the logic and rhetoric level? I think the most effective thing that I've found has two prongs. One is to give permission to use summaries either that I provide or that are available on the web, and say, look, the grammar of this will matter to you in order for you to get any further along. So let's make sure you have that. At the rhetoric level, if the obstacle is really still the physical practice of reading, the literature classroom isn't going to accomplish that on its own. So it really needs to be, I think, a school decision. Do you say about that student, we need to develop a plan that addresses the reading skill itself and worry about the other things later? Or do you say the content is so important to what we're doing that that needs to be our focal point and the slowness is just going to be a part of life for this student at this season? I suspect it's actually a combination of those things, that you look with your administration at the list of things that you're trying to accomplish and say, which is the short list of what this student should get to have some level of cultural literacy and depth of understanding and growth in understanding how to read literature well, and which are the expendable things when I can invest time in that skill that they're lacking and could develop in if we invested that time.
What are your favorite classroom practices / liturgies for teaching? And I would say that my favorite one, and this, I think this changes as students get a little bit older. My favorite is, start your class with prayer. And don't take prayer requests. Prayer requests are good for some time during your day. But we pray a very short prayer asking God's blessing and illumination in our class. And then we jump right in. And as we practice reading together, what I like to do is to have kind of an ongoing discussion with my students. And what I would say is the best kinds of discussions are ones in which you have to be vulnerable enough to be wrong. Okay? You have to be vulnerable enough to play devil's advocate. You have to be vulnerable enough to actually learn from your students. The favorite essay that I ever received from a student started like this. Mr. Fisher believes that Voltaire thinks this, comma, but he is wrong, period. And I remember taking out the big red pen, just tucking it behind my ear and saying, all right. And then at the end, I said, yeah, I think you're right. I blew it. I don't know anything about Voltaire. So those would be some of my favorites, but we have to get on to the next one.
You
want to take that one? I think it's aimed at me, I think. Okay. What of Hemingway, Faulkner, Flannery O'Connor, Cormac McCarthy? Really? Okay. You're the worst people I've ever had. Really? Nothing will last in the 150 years? Okay, let's just make a quick work of this. Hemingway, no. I mean, bartenders know how to make drinks. They don't need to read him. Faulkner, I don't think so. I mean, I think laborious. O'Connor, I'm going to take back, okay? O'Connor, I think O'Connor maybe, yes, probably. I love Flannery O'Connor. And Lewis and Tolkien, they will be read, But I don't know that it's because of the quality of the literature. It's because they actually saved Christian imagination. Okay? So that's their... It's not that Flannery O'Connor's work is that astounding. It's not Dante. But those three people, maybe more than anybody else, saved the Christian imagination in the midst of the apocalypse of the 20th century. So maybe O'Connor. I love Cormac McCarthy. Love his books. No. Nobody's going to read that 200 years from now. Come on. I stand with that one exception.
Talking about grading discussions, how do you deal with the students who listen and process but rarely comment? Though when they do, it's awesome. I do graded discussions in my class, and I do ungraded discussions. So I help them to get ready for the graded discussions in those ungraded times, and I remind them regularly, this is a good time to be wrong, because this is an ungraded moment. So let's go through that process. Ask your stupid questions now. Because you know there is such a thing as a dumb question, right? Whatever your teacher told you before. When I do the grading of discussions, a student who is attentive but not contributory will earn a C. They will not fail. So they have to recover from that in other aspects of their grade, but they're not walking into a classroom knowing, oh. But I also have said to students, okay, this graded discussion period is going to cover 3 days for us, and I want you to say one thing to get up to that C. I'm going to tell you what my first question is going to be, my starter point for the discussion tomorrow, and I want you to come in ready to give the first response. And then, when I introduce that day to the students, I say, if you have already said something, you have to sit back and hush until I give you permission to talk, because some people need more space in the air to make their contributions, and what they have to say deserves to be heard, and you need to hear it. So if you speak now, you'll actually lose points if you're in that category of oversharing.
Okay. Again, we're back to the bloodthirsty question here. If there's no good, worthy, and underlined, literature after Dickens, remember, I said before Dickens, what hope would you give an aspiring writer? What must a good book contain? And note this, that I did not say that there is no good, worthy literature after Dickens or before. You know, even before Dickens, including Dickens. What I'm talking about is great literature that'll be read. Homer is not going off the reading list ever. He's not. You're going to read the Iliad. If the world continues for 10,000 more years, the Iliad will be being read by students. And there's plenty of good literature to read. Dickens would be included in all of those other authors. So there's plenty of good literature. I just don't think that most modern stuff, maybe because we cut ourselves off from Christianity, I guess. I just don't think most of the modern stuff will survive in that same way to be read generation after generation. So Dickens would be a good thing to read.
For the good that's not great.
I think we're out of time.
Okay. Yep, we are.
Well, so. Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was a lot of fun. And my answer to that question would be that whatever authors you've had relationships with have added value to your life, and that's why you want them, but then you learn to have relationships with people who add different